I'm really fascinated by them because when I first looked at them, it took me back to my upbringing, believe you, and all the years of my upbringing, there was one thing that my mother insisted upon all 12 of us. Mind your P's and Q's. And we knew what that meant. You might not, but we knew what that meant. And when I looked at that, this is one of the messages that I got out of this Bible reading. Mind your P's and Q's. Because in this Bible reading, from Matthew 22:15-22, the scribes and Pharisees have come to Jesus and they're trying to give him that. They're trying to give him trouble and he has to mind his P's and Q's. Listen, just listen to this. Just listen to this and see what you get out of it. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin you used to proclaim the tax. They brought him a denarius and he asked him, whose image is this? And whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, so give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. When they heard this, they were amazed. And so they left him and went away. The second reading is from Luke 20:27-40. And with a similar situation, some of the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus with a question. Teacher, they said, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife but no children, the man must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now, there were 7 brothers. The first one married a woman and died childless. The second and then the third married her, and in the same way the 7 died, leaving no children. Finally, the woman died too. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be? Since the 7 were married to her. Good question. Jesus replied, the people of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of taking part in the age to come and in the resurrection from the dead will neither marry nor be given in marriage, and they can no longer die, for they are like the angels. They are God's children, since they are children of the resurrection. But in the account of the burning bush, even Moses showed that the dead rise. For he calls the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. For to him all are alive. Some of the teachers of the law responded, well said, teacher. And no one dared to ask him any more questions. I rest my case, Your Honor. It's good to get the dramatic readings when you're doing that noise. It's awesome. When we come to today's Bible readings, we see a number of different groups challenging Jesus with challenging questions. These questions come following Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem right towards the end of Jesus' earthly ministry. The Pharisees, Sadducees and Herodians are all hard at work trying to discredit Jesus. He threatens them. And this is the context of today's passages. In fact, these two challenges are part of four questions Jesus will either raise or answer. Next message, we'll look at the other two. Jesus engaging with these four questions, we find these in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Luke leaves out one of them, but apart from that, it's a series of four stories right one after another. And they're in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Again, what we see is Matthew, Mark, and Luke record very similar stories with very little difference, save using their own wording for the events and the teachings. Although in our reading from Luke, he does copy a fair bit from Mark, adds a little more information to help the reader understand what is being said and done, and shortens some of the wordier sections to a more plain Greek. But as you read the three accounts of all four questions, pretty much like all the teachings of Jesus when they are presented in the different Gospels, all the same beats are there. But I'm not going to spend too much time today looking at these differences. Rather, today we're going to start by asking, who exactly are the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Herodians? And why are they trying to discredit Jesus? And then we will look at the teachings Jesus gives them in his answers. I'm going to take you back to around 330 BC. Alexander the Great conquers much of the world, including Israel and Jerusalem. And so successful is this military campaign, the Greek cultural change brought across the Western world, the Middle Eastern world, and the Near Eastern world becomes permanent. This Hellenization of this part of the world remained, and the Greek language continues on as the unofficial language long after the fall of the Greek Empire. In 323 BC, Alexander the Great died, and his kingdom was split into four. Israel was right in the middle of two of them. To the south, you had Ptolemy. To the north, you had Seleucid. Ptolemy, from the south, conquered the territory of Jerusalem. And when he did so, he carried off to Alexandria many Jews, including most, if not all, of the Davidic descendants. In fact, more Jews lived in Alexandria after this than in Jerusalem at this time. This is when the Jews made synagogues for the first time, and they were made to be prayer houses and places where Jews could get together while living in Alexandria. But with the Davidic descendants carried off, the priests filled the power vacuum for the first time and became the political leaders as well as the spiritual leaders. Amongst the Jews, there were different schools of thought in terms of Greek culture. There were those who were happy with certain elements of Greek culture and Greek thinking, but still held the belief, but still knowing the God of Israel was the source of all wisdom. And this was probably most Jews at this time. There were the conservatives who refused any engagement with Greek culture. And then there were the progressives who fully embraced Greek culture. Doesn't that sound pretty familiar to today? People in the center, people conservative, people progressive. In 167 BC, so coming a little while further into the future now, in 167 BC, the Seleucids from the north took control of Jerusalem. They conquered it. And initially this went well for the Jews. They had all sorts of concessions. But after the Seleucids lost to the Romans, they had to pay massive reparations. And this changed the relationship between Antiochus IV, the king of the Seleucid Empire, and all the other countries they occupied and had conquered. What this meant is that Antiochus IV rebadged the temple to be dedicated to Zeus, called himself Epiphanes, meaning the presence of a god, and forced the sacrifice of pigs on the altar and the worship of Antiochus as a god. Well, this caused all the pious Jews to flee Jerusalem, seen this as the abomination of desolation written about in Daniel, and they started a rebellion. The conservative, priestly, but feisty family, the Hasmoneans, led this revolt. And in particular, the third son, Judas, the Hammer, or Judas Maccabeus, led this battle. The Maccabees had quite a bit of success. Surprising success, even. But in a battle with the Seleucids, it looked like the Maccabean revolt would be crushed. But it just so happened that Antiochus was killed in battle in modern-day Iran. And the Seleucid forces left the battle with the Maccabees to deal with the fallout. Well, this was seen as divine intervention. God had killed Antiochus and had delivered Israel from the hands of her enemies. The temple was rededicated to Yahweh under Maccabean leadership, and the festival of Hanukkah was established, which Jesus celebrated, by the way, in John 10. And one of Judas's brothers, Simon, becomes high priest and rules Jerusalem somewhat as a priestly king. Questions were asked: is this what God had in mind for the promised kingdom? After all, the Davidic descendants hadn't had any power for centuries. People were divided on this question. So Simon put in a clause which said that his family would rule until a prophet said otherwise. Hot old moment, John the Baptist. Why he's so important. Because you see, what Simon would then work to do is to bring about the idea that all prophecy had ceased. There were no more prophets. And this was became the accepted wisdom, that all prophecy had ceased. And it became almost impossible to see how God would fulfill his prophecy. In a few generations' time after Rome takes control over Israel and a Jewish convert gained political prominence, and in particular the trust of Rome, he has one of his sons, Herod, marry one of the Hasmonean princesses. And he becomes Herod the Great. And he becomes the king of the Jews. He gets to select who the high priest is, but is 100% sold out to Rome. What corruption there was in the leadership of Israel. King Herod the Great was a tyrant. However, he started to renovate the temple to become massive and impressive, and his work brought Jews across the world to come back to Israel and live. Was this God at work establishing his kingdom through Herod? Was this what God meant? And if not, how was a Davidic descendant ever going to become king now? As we come into Christmas, this should give us more insight into why King Herod wanted a descendant of King David's line called Jesus to be killed as a small child. Of course, by the time we get to Jesus' ministry, it's Herod the Great's son, Herod, who is king. In this landscape, there were those who supported King Herod and his claim as the king of the Jews, and these are the Herodians. There are the priests who retain political power and influence and were part of the Jewish aristocracy, descendants many of whom from the Hasmoneans. They preferred the Torah to the prophets, of course, and wanted the political status quo to remain so they could retain their power. This group was called the Sadducees. Now, there was another group who's not recorded in any biblical stories. They're a group of priests who thought that they should be the ruling priests and not the compromised Sadducees. They hated Rome and Israel relations and became pacifists, and had taken up at this time monastic life at Qumran. They knew that the politics of the day was impossible to decorrupt and that only God could establish a divinic king as the king of Israel. These priests were called the Essenes. This is where the Dead Sea Scrolls come from. As I said, they don't feature in our stories today, but they are significant. There was also a devout group of non-priests who retained conservative Jewish values and thought that their ideas need to be followed and spread so that God would liberate Israel. They were committed to their oral tradition. Above all else, that conservative oral tradition which went well beyond what scriptures taught. They engaged in a massive education program through the establishment of synagogues throughout Israel, prayer houses. Although being lay people, meaning not priests, through providing places of education and prayer, they gained prominence and respect. Anyone with aptitude could become a Pharisee, and the greatest teachers among them were called rabbis. So if you thought these days that we're living in now were the only times when there were many competing ideas for what God wants from us and confusion about different ideas of how politics and spiritual life work together and how on earth God's will is going to ever come to pass in today's climate, then I can tell you now, you are badly mistaken. In any case, now we know how we come to this moment in time with our Bible reading. Jesus had entered Jerusalem. He's a descendant of David. He threatens profoundly the political power and positions of Herod's supporters, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. John the Baptist was the prophet before him, which the Jewish leaders, of course, refused to recognize. But with Jesus' popularity growing, just how were the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Herodians going to stop Jesus? Jesus threatens the Pharisees because he is not on board with their ultra-conservative religious agenda. Jesus threatens Herod because he is a descendant of King David, amassing popular support. Jesus threatens the Sadducees because he could destabilize the current religious and political order. So they devised some clever questions to trick Jesus into saying something which would discredit him, or which they could use to twist to discredit him, to bring him into disrepute with the people. First, a group of Pharisees and Herodians come up to Jesus. Interesting bedfellows, I might say. But they have a common enemy, and they come and they lay it on thick, buttering Jesus up, but they're really positioning Jesus so that he has to give them an answer which will cause him problems. We know you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. In other words, Jesus, you're going to answer our question, not caring about the consequences of your answer, and if you don't, we can call your integrity into question. Of course, everything they say is true. Jesus is all these things. But they're not doing it for authentic reasons. Just this past week, I was talking to a naval navigator who spoke at the Ingham High School last week, and he told me a story of how a few years ago, personally, he didn't tell this to the kids, he told me personally a story about how a few years ago he went to China, quite a few years ago, I think, went to China in some soldier exchange program, for some reason, military exchange program for 2 weeks. And he spoke about the Chinese soldiers would try really hard to be very friendly, but they weren't very good at being friendly. They weren't very good at pretending to be friendly. So you could tell that they were pretending, and that they really just wanted to get the Australians to do something embarrassing so that they'd be compromised. They were trying too hard. And he said that it just made you feel slimy being around them. And this is the experience Jesus is having here. He begins by calling them out straight to their faces. You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? But then Jesus proceeds to answer their question. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. And what an amazing answer. Completely evading the trap while answering their question. But also, he turns the question from an either-or question into you do both. Caesar is the earthly authority whom God has allowed to rule. So give to Caesar the earthly things you are required to. Paying taxes is also serving God. But Caesar only has authority over earthly things. He doesn't have authority over your spirit, nor over your heart, nor over your devotion, nor worship. Serve God with everything you are. Give to God your all. Your attitudes, your relationships, your work, your social life, your worship. Give to God what is God's. God's reign is over everything, over earth and heaven. But part of giving to God what is God's is paying taxes and giving to earthly authorities the earthly things. Well, they were amazed at Jesus' answer. They didn't see that one coming. And realizing they had no chance of tricking Jesus and were only succeeding at increasing Jesus' legitimacy, they walk away. Later that day, the Sadducees gave it a go with what must have seemed to them a knockout piece of wisdom which showed the absurdity of the resurrected life. And therefore, Jesus, because he believed in the resurrected life. So they give Jesus the riddle. One man marries a woman, but if he has no children, then the brother is to marry the woman to have children for his brother. So a woman is married by seven brothers, each in turn die having had no children, and then the woman dies. All of the brothers have been equally married to her, so whose wife is she at the resurrection? This is actually the only recorded confrontation Jesus has with the Sadducees. Now, as I said, I like how Luke gives us some more details in Jesus' answer to help us fully understand what Jesus meant, but he misses out on a really cool line which Jesus said and recorded for us in Matthew and Mark. Matthew 22:29 and Mark 12:24. You are in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. What a wonderful answer to give to priests. Then he addresses the second part of that, the power of God. The Sadducees do not understand the power of God to be able to transform our current bodies into eternal bodies. Nor do they understand anything about the resurrected lives we will live in heaven. There will be no marriage in heaven. Rather, we will all be as married to Christ. Luke 20:24-36 spells it out clearly. The people of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of taking part in that age and in the resurrection from the dead will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They can no longer die, for they are like the angels. They are God's children, since they are children of the resurrection. Pretty clear. We are like the angels because we will have a perfect and immortal body, serving God wholly. But then, Jesus addresses their lack of knowing the scriptures. When God made himself known to Moses, God says, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. Jesus points, in fact, that God did not identify himself as the one who was the God of Abraham, but that he is still currently the God of Abraham as he speaks to Moses hundreds of years later. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. For to him all are alive. Again, Luke makes sure he includes the parts of Jesus' teachings which will help everyone understand the point being made. Abraham is still alive and God remains Abraham's God, even though Abraham is physically dead. To gain a greater understanding of this concept, we can see the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. When the rich man dies, he sees Lazarus and Abraham alive with God. So, Jesus is the great teacher. He can see through the fog of confusion that we might have as we struggle with difficult times and difficult concepts. How we should put together our political and religious lives. What we should believe is true. Jesus can see through the fog of all of this. And I guess that's because he's God, after all. So next time, we will look at the other two tough questions Jesus knows the answers to. Amen.